Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
The death toll is more than 150 people after a series of deadly explosions ripped through Baghdad today. The attacks started with a suicide car bombing that targeted construction workers assembled to find work for the day. Also today, 17 men were dragged from their homes in a village north of Baghdad and shot to death with machine guns. This latest violence comes on the same day the draft Iraqi constitution was finalized, ahead of a citizens' referendum scheduled for October 15th. Borzu Dargahi reports from Baghdad for the Los Angeles Times. He joins us again from there. And Borzu, as we have so many times, we're talking about more violence in Baghdad. But is this different? What's your sense?
Well, just in terms of the severity of the violence, it was very extreme. Also, the very direct targeting of civilians in the case of in northern Baghdad today. Just some poor people who are waiting for work, most of them from southern Iraq, and these folks come over here and they wait for the meager construction jobs that are available here. You know, these people are not political people; they're not security officials. In that sense, it was extreme in terms of the target.
What does that tell you?
It seems that this is a very, very concerted campaign to incite civil war. They are hitting so hard at very ordinary Iraqi Shiites in an attempt to overcome the relatively steady hand and relatively moderate tone of the Shiite clergy who, whenever one of these attacks happens, they say, you know, turn the other cheek. Revenge is un-Islamic. What they're doing is they're hitting so hard that it becomes increasingly more difficult to adopt a civil tone when one of these things happen. And the ultimate end game is civil war, to spark a civil war, to get the Shiites to start launching reprisals against the Sunnis, and thereby driving Iraq's Sunnis as well as the Sunni Arabs in Jordan, in Egypt, in Saudi Arabia, closer and closer to the brand of Wahhabi Islam and extremist Islamic activism as practiced by Osama bin Laden and Abu Musab al-Zarqawi.
Well, Al Jazeera is reporting that al-Qaeda is linking the attack today to the recent rout of militants from the city of Tal Afar by U.S. and Iraqi forces. Your thoughts?
Well, I'm very suspicious of those claims. Al Jazeera and Reuters and news organizations are citing a message posted onto a website that has ties to al-Qaeda. Now, I mean, you know, back in the States, we know about the Internet and how anything can go on the Internet. So is that al-Qaeda putting that message, or like some kid, you know, Mohammed from Bristol, England, who put something up on the message board somewhere? So I'd be cautious about that. But I will say that even some Iraqi politicians, some Sunni Arab Iraqi politicians today said that this was linked to what happened in Tal Afar. On the other hand, maybe they were just waiting for the right opportunity. Maybe they were just waiting for the right time to launch these attacks. They're very media savvy, it seems, these insurgents.
I was going to ask you, Borzu, you know, here in the U.S., the news has been, of course, of Hurricane Katrina and the aftermath almost exclusively. Is it possible that insurgents are monitoring that and saying perhaps, you know, now's the time, that's died down a little bit, the UN is gathering? Is there that possibility?
I suspect so, and I'm speculating, but I will say that at the time of the tsunami in Indonesia late last year, you had the same thing. You had the same thing happening where basically the attacks died down, you know. These guys do have access to satellite television. They do know what's going on in the world very, very, very well, instantaneously. You know, they are monitoring what the Western media says about them. They're monitoring what the Arabic media says about them. One of the first things, when I went up to a camp that was used by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi on the Iranian border, you know, it's like in the middle of the mountains, there was nothing there. There was no running water. There was no electricity. But there was a little internet depot, like the place where the Abu Musab al-Zarqawi went online, according to the people who live there. So, yeah, absolutely. It's quite possible.
Borzu Dargahi reports from Baghdad for the Los Angeles Times and is a frequent contributor here. Borzu, thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Well, we turn now to New York, where more than 150 world leaders are gathering for a summit marking the 60th anniversary of the United Nations. President Bush addressed the group and talked about the challenges facing the UN.
If member countries want the United Nations to be respected and effective, they should begin by making sure it is worthy of respect.
The meeting was preceded by bitter negotiations over the future of the organization and its role in combating terrorism and fighting poverty. A draft declaration was adopted, but most seemed to agree it is a weak and severely compromised document. Kofi Annan expressed disappointment, as did U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations John Bolton. Well, we're going to spend a few minutes today speaking about the U.N. First, for a sense of scene, we turn to Linda Fasulo. She covers the U.N. for NPR and NBC News. And Linda, this summit was years in the making. You know, after Rwanda and the Balkans, the hope was to come up with better ways to protect citizens. What's the mood there? Are delegates glum? Linda? There you are.
Hi. Can
Hi.
You hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Well, the situation is this. There have been really tremendously bitter negotiations going on here over the past few weeks. And what they obviously reflect is that we're dealing with a world that is very divided on many key issues. And as a result of the way the UN does business, meaning this document was meant to be a consensus document, which means that basically everyone has a veto over it. And so it ended up, as most people who watch how the UN works, it ended up being a rather not too strong and bold document. But nonetheless, Kofi Annan, of course, wanted something much, much stronger, and other countries feel it's a good start. It's a beginning. And the British ambassador said, after all, Rome wasn't built in a day.
Well, but, you know, we're hearing other people say, and we're going to speak to an analyst in a moment, that this meeting, you know, is on the brink of failure. So
I think that's a bit of a harsh assessment. I think that, you know, people would think that there were failure had they not even agreed to anything. But I think that, you know, you have varied countries from the United States, and you had mentioned John Bolton, to the Secretary General, two other representatives from many varied countries, sort of feeling that they got, some of the things they wanted. And it's very unrealistic to think that any country, given the cleavage and the deep divisions in the political, economic, and social systems around the world, that countries think alike. And if they don't think alike, they have very different goals, and they can't get them all into one document at the UN if it's going to be agreed upon by consensus.
Well, Linda, tell us, what are people telling you, either in front of or behind the scenes, is the main culprit, or are there many?
There are many. I mean, even the Secretary General said, you know, there were spoilers and during these negotiations, and part of the problem was the fact that it had to be agreed upon by consensus.
What did he mean by spoilers?
Some of the spoilers, depends who you speak to, but I think there are a group of developing countries who have a very large and vocal voice here, disproportionate to their role in the world, and the countries here who were very, very involved during these negotiations were countries like Cuba and Venezuela, Iran, Syria, Pakistan, who, you know, their critics will say have a vested interest in maintaining the status quo at the United Nations, particularly when it comes to management reform. And these countries sort of led the charge in refusing to budge very much in terms of strengthening the office of the Secretary General and helping to move UN management into the 21st century, so to speak.
Well, Linda, we want to spend about, you know, another minute with you. So in that time, tell me, what else jumped out at you from today?
I think what's interesting is, you know, they did manage to get this concept of a responsibility to protect civilians, protect populations from mm-hmm. genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing. And, you know, at least nations of the world will go on record in terms of, accepting this concept, which is new and was pushed for a long time, is a long time in the making.
In the face of some horrible failures in the past.
Exactly. And the Secretary General in his speech today said, you know, hopefully this will help prevent another Rwanda. I mean, there was disappointment regarding, you know, creating a new Human Rights Commission. They've left that to another day. They've basically agreed in principle, but, you know, the details have to be worked out. And there's great disagreement, again, between group countries like Cuba and those so-called spoilers, the United States and others who want, you know, a more effective council.
Mm-hmm. And definitions of terrorism and things
exactly.
like that.
Exactly. They couldn't get that definition. They did get a condemnation of terrorism in all its forms and manifestations committed by, you know, in typical UN language, whomever, wherever, and for whatever purpose. But there still is great differences in terms of who is a terrorist, and Arab countries, you know, did not want to give up an exemption for national liberation groups under occupation.
Mm-hmm.
There seems, you know, if you speak to EU and countries from developing countries, you know, there has been movement regarding development and the push to eliminate poverty. It's not perfect, but there is a commitment for an additional $50 billion a year for fighting poverty by 2010, and there's commitments on the part of developing countries to adopt the plans that are necessary.
Linda Fasulo, reporter covering the United Nations. She's at the summit meeting in New York. Linda, we're going to touch back with you at other points, but thank you so much today.
Great. My pleasure.
Well, now we're going to turn to our guest. Nancy Soderberg was an alternate rep to the UN during the Clinton administration. She's now the vice president of multilateral affairs with the International Crisis Group. She joins us from Florida. Nancy, welcome.
How are you?
We're also joined by Joshua Moravchik. He's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He studies the UN. We're going to spend a few minutes with you, but we have a break coming up. Before that, Nancy, I just want to turn to you because you did write today that you felt that this meeting was on the brink of failure. And the minute we have, you know, Linda says maybe not that bad. What do you think?
Well, I think it has been teetering on the brink of failure for the last couple of weeks. And I think the diplomats never want to admit to their arriving heads of state that they have failed. So they cobbled together a document that gives them enough to save face but fails to meet the challenges of really moving the UN into the 21st century.
Yeah. And Joshua Moravchik, your first take on what's happened, just give us your overriding thought on what has been the result so far of the summit.
Well, it's a failure by any reasonable definition, although that's not surprising. But what is really especially shocking is that we couldn't get meaningful progress either on condemning terrorism or on creating a better human rights mechanism.
Well, and as we just heard, it's because the delegates can't define terrorism. I'm going to ask you both to just stay there for just a second. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, more analysis. And that question that keeps getting raised, is the UN possibly too broke to fix? We'll be joined by our guests when we come back. Hope you're there, too. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Morning. We're spending a few minutes on the future of the UN as more than 150 world leaders gather in New York for the largest global summit in history. We're joined by Nancy Soderberg. She served as an alternate rep to the UN in the Clinton administration, as well as Joshua Moravchik. He's a fellow resident at the American Enterprise Institute. He writes about the UN. And Joshua, I want to pick up with you because we were talking about one of the stumbling blocks that we're witnessing, and that is the definition of terrorism. Some countries want to distinguish between insurgents in occupied countries and terrorists. Hasn't it always been ever thus, you know, one man's freedom fighter and all of that?
No, this is really nonsense, Robin. It's a semantical game that's played by the people who support terrorism. They know perfectly well that it's just a trick. That is, they say terrorism should be defined by whether you're fighting for a good cause or not. But This is just sort of an abuse of language and of logic. It's perfectly clear that terrorism is a kind of action, that is an action that deliberately targets civilians, that blows up babies and children and women. And it doesn't have to do with whether the cause is good or bad.
Well, Nancy, I want to know, do you agree? And if so, move on to what you think is the biggest stumbling block.
Well, I think really what I agree with Josh, there's no excuse in this day and age for terrorism under any guise. And what you're seeing here is a fascinating window into the state of the world's ideological development. On the one hand, you have the developing world that wants to still live in the 1960s, where one man's freedom fighter is just that, not a terrorist. And they don't want to reform the UN. They're not giving the Secretary General the right to manage it. They're blocking a human rights standard for a new human rights council because they're afraid that that human rights council might look into their own repressive background.
Well, in fact, I want to stop you there, Nancy, because the Human Rights Commission is, of course, a concern. There's long been criticism that it's stocked with countries that have terrible human rights records. President Bush referenced this in his comments. Let's just listen.
When this great institution's member states choose notorious abusers of human rights to sit on the UN Human Rights Commission, they discredit a noble effort and undermine the credibility of the whole organization.
Joshua, you know, it's a point many make. Do you see any movement on the Human Rights Commission?
Well, the movement is that Kofi Annan himself, you know, weighed in very heavily on this in his report that was issued in March. He said that the Human Rights Commission, as it was a stain on the United Nations. So we and he, who are often at odds, the U.S. and Kofi Annan, were quite on the same page on this. But surprisingly, the force of the human rights abusers was strong enough so that they were able to block meaningful progress on it.
Well, and just quickly on Kofi Annan, Nancy, your thoughts. I mean, he obviously, the members, many of them, have not followed his lead.
Well, what he did was put out a new bargain for the world, where the developing world would get serious about the threats the U.S. perceives, terrorism and nonproliferation, in exchange for the U.S. getting serious about the threats of the developing world, which is primarily poverty, debt, HIV, AIDS, and infectious diseases. Neither side is prepared to take up that challenge. And what you're seeing here is the U.S. playing its ideological hot buttons on the development, Kyoto, abortion rights, things like that are important to the developing world, not committing to those things. And there's nothing in this document about definition of terrorism or proliferation progress. The rules of the road are still non-existent in some cases for weapons of mass destruction that may fall into the hands of terrorism. So you have a lot of blame on both sides going around.
I was going to say, plenty to go around. The U.S. has also been criticized, Joshua, for not coming up with the money that Kofi Annan has requested that all countries contribute. He's asked they all pay a certain percentage in aid. The U.S. says no. Remind us of that.
The so-called Millennium Development Goals that Kofi Annan pushed and that were endorsed in earlier UN meetings call on every country to spend 0.7% of its GDP on aid, and the U.S. has resisted this. And I think there are two sides to that. On the one hand, I think that the U.S. is not as generous as it ought to be with foreign aid. On the other hand, U.N. development programs and U.N. aid programs have a notoriously bad record, and there's a good reason to be skeptical about whether a U.N. development plan for the world will, in fact, lead to much development.
So, Nancy Soderberg, we come to the question that gets asked frequently. After a disappointing day, although we heard from Linda Fasulo that many of the delegates felt they got more than they thought they'd get from so many disparate countries, but the question's always raised, has the time for the UN passed?
Absolutely not. I mean, I think the UN has got to be central to moving the world forward, but it's got to be given the tools to do it. And unfortunately, this summit has failed to do that. They'll have to just retake up the challenge next year. I mean, if you just look at what's going on in the world, there the World Food Development Program is feeding millions around the world. The World Health Program is solving infectious diseases around the world. I think Josh is wrong in that the UN is not capable of effectively providing this type of assistance. And when you're dealing with rules of the road to crack down on terrorism and proliferators, you need to go to the UN. Even the Bush administration has begun to recognize that and work more constructively.
That's Nancy Soderberg with the International Crisis Group. Sorry, Nancy, we just have a minute left. She was also an alternate rep to the UN. And Josh, you've just got a few seconds, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Your thoughts, future of the UN?
Well, I think the humanitarian work of the UN is commendable, but its political work has been a failure for 60 years, and it's time we worked more on replacing the UN with other kinds of institutions, coalitions, alliances, regional organizations, and cooperation among democracies.
Two different opinions. That's Joshua Smoravich. He's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Thank you both for weighing in as the leaders meet in New York on a frustrating day for the UN. Thank you both.
My pleasure.
And stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from members of the Senate Judiciary Committee continue to press Supreme Court Chief Justice nominee John Roberts on day two of his confirmation hearings. And we wanted to check in with Professor Jonathan Turley from the George Washington University Law School. He's following the hearings. And Jonathan, first of all, one specific case discussed caught our attention. Roberts said that Congress can counter Supreme Court rulings, such as the recent controversial decision on eminent domain in Connecticut. That's the one that gives cities broad power to seize people's homes for private development. He says Congress can counter them. What do you make of that?
Well, he is stating a clear truism. I mean, I just testified in the House of Representatives on that legislation, and I also said that they could effectively counter it. That's really nothing new. The court itself, in its decision, said that legislatures could effectively bar the use of eminent domain, because what the Supreme Court said was, we're leaving this up to the political process. So if you want to bar it, if you want to expand it, it's up to you. We're just not going to get involved.
Did John Roberts say anything more about perhaps the High Court overturning such a ruling? Because remember, yesterday, a lot of the conversation was about whether or not law could be overturned by the court.
No. This has been truly the cure to insomnia for the last few days. He has said nothing. In fact, reporters constantly run out of the room and call me and say, oh my gosh, I think he just said he won't overturn Roe. And in reality, he's been saying what are legal truisms over and over again in different ways. What's a bit confusing is where his principled line is in refusing to answer these questions. He has addressed some cases, whether he thinks they're well decided, like Griswold versus Connecticut, while refusing to address others like Roe. And it is not true that a judicial nominee cannot discuss hypotheticals or his general views on privacy. That's not barred under judicial ethics. What's barred is to address a specific case that may come before them.
Right, and he is holding forth on that, and he's saying that. In the few seconds we have, what else jumped out at you, just briefly, if you could?
Well, the thing that's most surprising is to hear Republican senators trashing the court for reversing or overturning federal statutes. It was the conservatives on the court that did that. And so when people like Specter and Grassley are saying, we want you to be different, they're asking him to be more like John Paul Stevens and Ginsburg, the left side of the court.
Well, perhaps they were hoping you wouldn't notice. Jonathan Turley teaches law at the George Washington University Law School. He's following the hearings, as we will. Jonathan, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, now, more on the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. The state of Louisiana is investigating the deaths of some of its most vulnerable residents, 45 patients whose bodies were found this week at an evacuated New Orleans hospital, and 34 nursing home residents who died possibly because their building was not evacuated. On top of all of this, the Louisiana governor and FEMA are once again trading accusations about who's responsible for the removal of dead bodies. Well, joining us on the phone from New Orleans is Washington Post reporter Peter Borwisky. And Peter, to the nursing home story first, this was St. Rita's Nursing Home in St. Bernard Parish. What do we know about what happened there?
What is known is that they've recovered 34 bodies from the nursing home, and that they've charged the owners of the nursing home with 34 counts of negligent homicide. The state attorney general says that they were offered, the owners of the nursing home were offered buses to transport their patients out of the city to, in a little place called Violet, which is in St. Bernard's Parish, and declined the offer.
This is the nursing home that we've spoken of where someone, perhaps an elderly resident, tried to use furniture to stop the water. Neighbors chopped a hole in the roof and saved some residents. What is the lawyer for the owners, the Manganos? What is he saying?
There's two attorneys for the Manganos, and one of them told me last night that he says that when all the facts are known, people will consider the Manganos heroes. What we're hearing is that the Manganos and their children and their grandchildren were in the nursing home during the storm, that as the waters rose, they made valiant efforts to save as many people as they can. He said they saved 50 people out of the nursing home.
Yeah. We've also heard one lawyer for the Manganos say that the nursing home actually made it through the hurricane. It was the levee break that was the problem, and he feels that the blame should be on the federal government, the Army Corps of Engineers, for not repairing that levee. Have you heard that?
I've heard that they made it through the hurricane, and it was the flooding afterwards that it caused the trouble for them.
Yeah. We've also read another account of a family member of a resident being reassured the home would be evacuated, then being told that it might be too risky for the sicker residents. Is there some sense that that this might be true, that some of the residents were too sick to be moved?
Well, that's what their attorneys are saying, that it was a very difficult choice for them to make because they felt that in the rushed circumstances that would, an evacuation would have had to take place. Some of the patients would have died, you know, some of whom are on respirators and other medical equipment, may have died just in the act of evacuation. So they describe it as a very difficult choice. They chose to stay.
Yeah.
From the state, from the Attorney General's point of view, you know, the Manganos had a choice. They had filed an evacuation plan with St. Bernard's Parish. That evacuation plan was not followed.
Yeah. We're going to be speaking in a moment, Peter, with a woman here in Massachusetts who was able to locate her mother, who'd been evacuated out of a nursing home, but it was a hellish time trying to find her. And it's unusual that people are finding their relatives. We read in today's New Orleans Times-Picayune about a woman whose mother, an 85-year-old Alzheimer's patient, was at St. Rita's, and no one knows whether she is alive or dead. What are authorities saying about why it's so hard to track these people?
Well, for one thing, they haven't positively identified the victims in the St. Rita's case. It's not like they can just take a look at a list and say, oh, that person is deceased.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're also understanding that state officials are trying to find out about the deaths of 45 patients at Memorial Medical Center in New Orleans. We are reading accounts of doctors and nurses who acted heroically to save as many people as they could after generators failed, and they had no food, water, or electricity. What exactly will the Attorney General's office in Louisiana be investigating in the hospital case?
I think that they'll look at what evacuation plan the hospital had and whether or not they followed that plan. That seems to be the key issue from the Attorney General's point of view, not what heroic efforts might have been made after the storm had passed and the people are still there.
Yeah. Overall, what are health officials saying about the evacuation system for these needy residents of New Orleans?
Colonel Ebert, who's the head of emergency preparedness departments at the city of New Orleans, says that they had an evacuation plan, but this catastrophe overwhelmed their emergency plan. This thing essentially was too big to plan for.
Peter Worisky, reporting from New Orleans for The Washington Post. Peter, thank you.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Here and Now. Well, Tracy O'Day, a single mother of two toddlers who lives in Amesbury, Massachusetts, lost track of her elderly mother in New Orleans for a harrowing time. Tracy's 74-year-old mother, Phyllis Galati, has Alzheimer's. Phyllis was evacuated from her New Orleans nursing home when floodwaters poured into the city. She went to one of the big shelters. But then, Tracy, what happened then?
It was really scary, Robin. After the hurricane subsided the second or third day, she was taken back to her nursing home, and they had a generator which would last for about 2 weeks and some food and some water, and they thought they were going to be okay to just stay there. However, shortly after the levee broke, as everyone knows, the looting began. They were planning on splitting up the group and getting them outside. However, their bus right in front of the nursing home was hijacked at gunpoint. So I lost her. Shortly after that, I lost her again for another 4 days, and it was just a nightmare. I mean, the first time was bad. The second time was even worse because, as you know, things just went to hell down there. You know, I tried everything I could to try to find her. I went through FEMA, the Red Cross. You know, there was no national databank of who was being brought into the dome or any of the other places. It was horrible.
Oh, it sounds it. She did end up in a home in Baton Rouge, and you finally located her there. But I'm wondering, let's stop at the Superdome. Did you say Superdome or Convention Center?
See, everyone was torn apart and split up, and my mother's unable to relay things to me. I'm taking the word on nursing staff that had accompanied her, so it's unclear. She was either in the convention center or the dome.
Either way, we know how horrendous the situation was there.
I did learn when she made it to Baton Rouge from the nursing staff at the home, Jefferson Manor, where she was relocated to, that they said that they witnessed firsthand rapes and murders. You know, Alzheimer patients live in each moment, and in that moment, she's experiencing fear and confusion, and, you know, it's a nightmare.
Well, but the nightmare ended
because
I want to bring someone else on the line. Diane Spaulding is on the line. She's marketing director of Harborside Healthcare Maplewood, which is also in Amesbury, Massachusetts, happened to work with Tracy's boyfriend, found out that they were looking all over for Tracy's mom. And Diane, you started and were part of an effort to do what?
To try to help them locate her mother. And I had said to Dave, this is what I do. We'll bring her up here and we're going to take her. So at that point, I just started making phone calls and working with Tracy and then hearing that we found her. Then we lost her again and trying to call different agencies to help me find a flight down there. That was the hardest part of all.
Now, we understand, as you're doing this, people start donating money. People started giving you the money to help you do this.
Absolutely. I mean, we opened up a fund to, you know, put the money in called the Phyllis Fund. Just watching what Tracy was going through and the anguish, her emotional feeling of not being able to get her mother and what her mother has seen.
And then you sent some of your employees down to get her?
Oh, absolutely. They did not think twice of saying, get us on that plane, Diane. We're going. Harborside Healthcare gave us T-shirts, towels, hard candy. The nurses needed hard candy, and we sent down flyers to see if anyone else needed to come up or needed help. And now these two girls are going to go back down there because they're on a personal mission to help the rest of the people in these nursing homes or nurses that needed scrubs.
Meanwhile, Tracy, how's your mom?
Oh my gosh, she looks good.
Does she know what's going? I mean, how much do you think she knows?
She has moments that glimmers where I think she knows who I am, but it's kind of heart wrenching because I have to keep reminding her that I'm her daughter and where she is. Mm-hmm. She bonded immediately with the nurses from Harborside that went down there. They took such good care of her.
How could you have done this yourself?
Oh, God, no. And Diane just came in and took it over.
Well, it's very scary because I just know that we are constantly, we live near the nuclear plant and we have a disaster plan. We have drills all the time. And did you see those pictures of the empty wheelchairs and you see the pile of walkers? It makes you sick to your stomach to see. Because you know what? It could be any one of our mothers.
Diane Spaulding, she's marketing director for Harborside Healthcare Maplewood in Amesbury, Massachusetts. Tracy O'Day was reunited with her mother, who's now at Harborside. They had the reunion yesterday at Boston's Logan Airport. More ahead here and now. Julie Otsuka's first novel, When the Emperor Was Divine, was first published in 2002 to glowing reviews. It told of a family uprooted by the order to evacuate Japanese Americans from the West Coast following the bombing of Pearl Harbor in 1941. Some 120,000 Japanese Americans, the majority of them U.S. citizens, were forced to leave their homes and stay in hastily erected internment camps in barren, isolated areas. Julie's grandfather was arrested by the U.S. government shortly after the attack. Her grandmother, mother, and uncle were interned. Old letters between them helped inspire the book. Emperor could have had the fate of many first novels, lots of praise but no sales. But after 9/11, it found a home on scholastic reading lists, as many teachers found parallels to today. Recently, we spoke with Julie Otsuka about her book, and we asked her to remind us, why were the Japanese Americans relocated?
The official line that was given by the government was that they were considered to be a military threat, and it was feared that if Japan attacked the West Coast after having attacked Pearl Harbor, that the Japanese Americans living on the West Coast would rise up and side with the invading army. So the idea was to get them off the coast where they were considered to be a danger to the population. But actually, I think the reasons are much more complex for their internment. I think racism was probably the main factor behind their internment.
In fact, later on in the book, there are soldiers that are accompanying them to the internment camps who are saying, pull down your shades and the trains, because this was an effort to, in some small way, protect the Japanese Americans.
That's correct. They were occasionally attacked. The climate then was extremely anti-Japanese. There are many, many incidents of violence around that time.
In the meantime, the two children in the family that we soon meet, the boy and the girl, as American, you know, as they can be, as we learn about them, and the woman tells her son to tell people he's Chinese. Did that happen?
Actually, it did happen. I remember my mother telling me a story about she was shopping with her mother in Berkeley, and a man came up to her and asked her if she was Chinese or Japanese. I think she shouted Japanese and then ran away from him as quickly as she could.
Would you do us a favor of reading from the bottom of page 70 after this long train trip? They're in the camp, and it just there's a description of the rumors that are flying around this camp that's really just some makeshift housing.
Every week they heard new rumors. The men and women would be put into separate camps. They would be sterilized. They would be stripped of their citizenship. They would be taken out onto the high seas and then shot. They would be sent to a desert island and left there to die. They would all be deported to Japan. They would never be allowed to leave America. They would be held hostage until every last American POW got home safely. You've been brought here for your own protection, they were told. It was all in the interest of national security. It was a matter of military necessity. It was an opportunity for them to prove their loyalty.
What is the sense you're trying to convey of who these people were and who they were loyal to? Because there do seem to be a couple of characters who, you know, who are praying at night to the emperor.
Most of the people in the camps were actually very young and American-born and were in many ways very all-American. But the parents, the older generation, many of them were born in Japan and were first-generation immigrants and felt actually extremely conflicted, I think, by the war itself. But they knew that it was not safe to express any sort of feeling or longing for their homeland at that time.
Well, this family eventually leaves. But before we get to that, your book, as we said, is being embraced by educators because it resonates post 9/11 when there were reports of anti-Arab violence. But I'm wondering also, as horrible as any racist attacks are, I'm wondering, did you also find yourself thinking, you think this is bad, it doesn't compare to post-Pearl Harbor incarceration of Japanese Americans?
No, I didn't, because I think that this is bad.
Mm-hmm. What have you heard from teachers?
I think that many of the young people now aren't really aware of what happened here during World War II. And I don't think that the internment of the Japanese is something that's mentioned in the history books even now. I think that students can make the connection themselves between what is happening here now, post 9/11, to Muslims and Arabs, and what was happening to the Japanese post Pearl Harbor.
This renewed interest in telling children about what happened after World War II to Japanese Americans has, of course, made your book have this success. Just a quick thought on that. You know, you spend 6 years putting a novel together, and then this comes out of the blue.
I didn't really expect anything to happen with the book at all. I didn't expect there to be very much interest And I have mixed feelings also about it resonating the way that it does. I mean, I think it's sad in a way that what's happening now really does remind us of an earlier time. And I wonder if we've learned anything at all. And yet, if it can mean something to people today, then in a way that's also a form of solace for me.
How much of it was from your own family story?
The events are based on events that happened to my own family, but the emotions felt were completely made up, and the personalities of the characters in the novel don't resemble the personalities of the characters in my own family.
Well, there's so much exquisite detail in the book about what the kids did to pass their time in the camps, how they dreamed about their father, where he might be, or dreamed about having a Coke, you know, so American. Where did you get those details other than from the letters?
Details I got mostly from my research, and I think for some reason childhood is, it's very, I don't know, it's very accessible to me, that just that mindset. Especially, I think that the boy, the character of the boy came very naturally to me.
Speaking of the 8-year-old boy, he's always dreaming and thinking and wondering what's going on, why is this happening? And he, in one segment, says, what if he stopped biting his nails and remembered to do everything the first time he was told and said his prayers every night before bed and ate all of his coleslaw, even when it was touching the other food on his plate? That might just do the trick. And, you know, get them out of the internment camp and get him back to his father. In other words, you know, what did I do to get here?
Right. I mean, he thinks in a way, he thinks that he's done something terrible and that the internment is all his fault. And he's definitely a magical thinker. He's just too young to really understand what is happening to him. So he makes up his own reasons, which are quite awful, I think, in a way.
And then,
imagine that it's all your fault.
Yeah. And when he and his sister and mom have their reunion, they've been back for a year or so from the internment camp. Their father finally comes home. He's not the man they remember, obviously, you know, crushed by his experience. And they say this, he never told us what it was exactly he'd been accused of, sabotage, selling secrets to the enemy, conspiring to overthrow the government. Was he guilty as charged? Was he innocent? Was he even there at all? We didn't know. We didn't want to know. We never asked. All we wanted to do now that we were back in the world was forget. And I just wonder, how common was that experience of people returning from internment and never talking about it?
I think it was very common. I think that many Japanese Americans after the war just wanted to really forget about what had happened to them. And their main task at hand, in any case, after the war, was just picking up the pieces and trying to start their lives all over again, which was not an easy thing to do. And many of them, after the war, destroyed all of their Japanese possessions. Just, I think they tried to downplay their Japanese-ness just as a means of survival. So many of them destroyed their Japanese belongings, family heirlooms, things like that.
We're talking to Julia Otsuka, whose book about the internment of Japanese Americans is now being embraced by teachers, and it's on reading lists. And so, you know, American students are talking about that time. Has this book that you know also provoked Japanese families to talk about it, Japanese American families?
I think that more Japanese American families are talking about it anyway on their own, just because so many of the former internees are very old now and they're reaching the ends of their lives. And I think many of them do feel that now is the time to speak.
And Julia Otsuka's book is called When the Emperor Was Divine. It's now out in paperback. It tells the story of the internment of Japanese Americans after the attack on Pearl Harbor. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next.